Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from The Kosher Scene. Those of you who are regular readers of our blog, The Kosher Scene, at kosherscene.wordpress.com, know that we have spoken many, many times to Chef David Kolatkin, the corporate chef at Prime Hospitality Corporation. You also know that no matter how many times we have spoken to him, no matter how many times we have tasted his cooking, we always come back for more and more. In fact, he happens to be our favorite chef in New York. So tonight I have the pleasure of interviewing Chef David Kolatkin, who just published a cookbook directly at Prime Grill. We are coming to you from Prime Grill, and every time I walk into this new location, every time I am amazed at how beautiful the place looks. Like any true work of art, it is something that constantly evolves, both in the food that they serve, both in the way the atmosphere or the place is. Good evening, Chef David.
Good evening, Chaim. How are you doing? Nice to have you here at the Prime Grill, as it always is.
Let me ask you, what made you decide that your life's work was going to be cooking? What made you decide to become a chef? Of all the possible jobs, all the possible occupations or professions that a nice Jewish boy was expected to do, especially in your generation, being a chef was not exactly one of the most famous ones, was not exactly one of the main things. I mean, every Jewish mother wanted her little boy to become a doctor, a lawyer, or some professional like that. And yet, you became a chef, but not just a chef. You made an art out of it. Where did that passion come? What first motivated you to become a chef?
And it's funny you say that, because you're right. During, you know, my time growing up, my grandmother, my mother, you know, they wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor. And these days, lawyers and doctors don't do too well. Back in those days, chefs weren't really being recognized at the time, where now they really are, with, you know, reality TV shows and internet radio and all these cool things. And it's funny, because when I enrolled at the culinary back in 1991, I came back for Thanksgiving Day weekend, and I was all but 18 years old at the time, and my grandmother had us all over, and I had my knife kit and my uniform, and I went to the bathroom and put on my chef's toque and my chef whites and my checkered pants and my neckerchief. When I came out, my grandma says, "Oy vey, he's a doctor, he's a food doctor." And I'll never forget that. So at least I gave her half of her wishes. You know, I became a food doctor. This all started, you know, when I was a kid. My parents would take my sister and myself up to the Catskills, and we used to call it the Jewish Mountains. And
right.
We go to Kutcher's, and I think the Concord, and we go some months for 10 days, 14 days, and it's fun. I would always meet friends, and my dad would always tell us to take advantage of, you know, of the food scene, because there's going to be so much of it. And I just remember always looking forward to playing with my friends all day, but getting together with my parents at night for dinner. And it wasn't until a few years later where my father actually took Dawn and I, my sister Dawn, to an Italian restaurant in the old part of Long Beach, Long Island, New York. And we ordered a Caesar salad, and the coolest thing was that the guy came with a little gyrodon, which is like a little table on wheels, and he had a bowl, he had a whip, and he had a pepper mill, and he cracked a couple egg yolks into this bowl, and he added some Parmesan cheese, and added some anchovies, and he rubbed garlic on the side of the wooden bowl to infuse the bowl with the garlic, which eventually infused the dressing. Then he slowly started emulsifying, with drizzling slowly olive oil into the eggs. And he made this dressing right in front of our eyes, and I said, "Wow, this is pretty cool and intriguing." And we started cooking a lot. You know, my mom always put fantastic meals together at home. You know, there's always protein with a starch and a vegetable, and we always had to finish our vegetables before we could go and watch TV afterwards, or if we were going to be able to have like something sweet afterwards. My mom always made it very clear that we had to, you know, to have a complete meal. And with my father, we'd do some cooking. My parents split up when I was 10. So I'd go to his house, and after that experience with the Caesar salad, you know, we just started cooking every Friday. Every Friday we'd cook. And that's how it began. And then I took it to a new level. At one point where I was looking to go into the hotel and restaurant business, maybe go to Cornell or something like that. But then I just zoned in on the culinary aspect of it. So I started working through high school. When I was 15, I was stocking shelves at a place called Awesome Drugstore in Huntington, Long Island, where I grew up. And I left my career as Stock Boy of the Year to go to a restaurant called Villa Adriano and wash pots. And as most times in the restaurant industry, there's always a big turnover in kitchen staff. And I think that the salad man came drunk and got sent home, and next thing you know, from Stock Boy of the Year to illustrious pot washer, I became a salad man. And from there, I became hot appetizer man. And then, you know, I pursued another position at another restaurant in the village. And, you know, during high school, I didn't go to yeshiva. I went to public school. I do Hebrew school on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while everyone was having their parties and playing sports, you know, I was washing pots, trying to pursue a career in the culinary world. And when I went to the Culinary Institute of America, they had, I think it was 12 months of mandatory experience in the restaurant before they'd even look at your grades. That was like the key thing there. You don't have to be brilliant to be a chef, but you do have to have drive and ambition, and they wanted you to have that experience so you could understand what a difficult lifestyle it is. Because it is a very difficult lifestyle. It's, you know, weekends, nights, and holidays generally. And it's a long road, but I pursued it, and I've been at a chef school since 93. I got into the Culinary Institute due to my experience and letters of recommendation, and I think I had a B average or so in high school. And I did a two-year program, and I interned at the world-famous 21 Club, and when I finished school, they hired me full-time, and I did another 3 years there, and the story goes on. But that's how I got started.
And for a while, you were also at the Metropolitan, at the Metropolitan Museum.
Yes, I left the 21 Club. As a kid, I was over 21 years old, I think, and I was the head saucier on the nighttime line at the 21 Club. And that means pretty much that there's a brigade in every kitchen. So, of course, the executive chef is in number one. Then he usually has an executive sous chef and then a sous chef underneath, depending on the size of the restaurant. Small restaurants might have a chef who actually cooks on the line, and his sous chef is his second cook on the line, and they might have a cook and a pot washer. But the 21 Club, we had banquet rooms, we had a large dining room, we did high volume, and of course it wasn't kosher. And so you had the chef, you had his executive chef and his executive sous chef and his sous chef, and then would come the saucier on the line. So I was the head of the line, so there's about five or six people underneath me. And I was 21. I mean, that's all I have to say. It's pretty wild. And I wanted to become sous chef, and my mentor, Michael Amonico, did me a favor by not making me sous chef, because he didn't want me to grow up the brigade too fast. Because once you become sous chef in management, you really, you don't go back. You just, you know, if I get a resume and someone was a sous chef and they applied to me for a cook's position, I always question that, because why go back? So he gave it to someone else, and I was stubborn, so I left. I was offered a position by a friend of mine that I actually worked on the line with at the 21 Club. Mm-hmm. This guy Lenny Over, and he was a sous chef at this place called, it was the Trustees Dining Room at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It was for the trustees only, so it was not open to the public. So So they brought me in as, they called it a chef de partie position, where I was, you know, pretty much on the meat side of the line, doing all the rack of lamb and the sauteing, the roasting. And I was there for about a year or so. And I enjoyed it because the hours were not very intense. I think I worked a 35-hour work week. And a funny story, because back then, talking salaries, I think I was making 20 grand a year there.
What year was this?
This was in 94, maybe.
That wasn't so bad in 94.
Let me see, 91, 93, maybe 95-ish. It's probably like 95-ish, so yeah. So I was making 27 or 28 grand a year, and I had an offer.
Even for a young kid, that's 21, 22, I mean, that's...
Well, it was fine. I was very livable. I had roommates. I had no responsibilities, except to get myself to work. And I was working 35 hours a week, which is like unheard of in this profession. Right. So the old sous chef of the 21 Club, Craig Cupani, took a job as executive chef at this little place called Butterfield 81 on 81st and 3rd, down the block from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and offered me a sous chef position. And I asked for 37 grand, and he hired me at 34 and said that you have to leave room for a raise. So I took the 34,000, so I was making another, what, 6,000 more annual. But what he didn't tell me is that I was going to be working 75 hours a week. And I was making literally like another $50 of my paycheck at the time. And,
boy.
And it's just, it's a true story, and it happens. And I did that for a year, and then I went back with my mentor, Michael Amango. He took the job. He left the 21 Club and took the job as chef director of Windows on the World at the top of building number one of World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
And he hired me as a senior sous chef there. So now I was, I think, 24, 25. And the biggest raise I ever took, I went from 34 to 55 to $50,000, just like that, from one job.
Whoa.
To another. So.
And how many hours to 75?
No, because it was very, very livable and civil. We had, it's a huge restaurant. In season, we'd employ 400 people.
Wow.
We had two floors of building one of the original Twin Towers. And we had banquets. We had a company cafeteria. We had... The Windows on the World kitchen was the main event, which is where I focused. And then you had a place called the Greatest Bar on Earth, which had its own kitchen. And you had a place at the time called Cellar in the Sky, which changed over to Wild Blue while I was there. So you had all these establishments. So we had probably had, like, I think 20, 25 people cooking at one time. No, maybe like it was like a 19-man line or 15-man line at Windows on the World. So I was... pretty much on expo, I was, you know, would lead the prep kitchen and make the sauces and stocks and make sure we had enough mise en place or preparation, as they say, to go into a busy service. And we'd call orders and everyone cooked them and we'd sling the food out. You know, we'd stack trays and sometimes 3-4 high. And we fed huge amounts of people, very good food. And that was my experience at Windows on the World. I did that for about 3 years.
And how did you eventually come to Frank Grill? And what made you decide to become chef for a kosher restaurant, considering all the limitations?
Well, I left Windows on the World to go as chef cuisine to a place called Patroon, which at the time had 3 stars. And I was there for about a year or so. And then this is kind of, it's not that I want all your listeners to hear this, but I'm an honest guy, and I guess maybe that's why I'm working in a kosher restaurant. But it was the first time in 10 years that I actually got let go. I never had to take a resume out. It's so funny. They gave me this diploma from the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, and I never had to show it to anybody. I never had to take a resume out because I was getting pulled from one job to another. So finally, we closed Patroon to renovate, and we were opening another establishment called 92 on 92nd and Madison, in the Wales Hotel, I believe it was. And I was, I was helped open that restaurant as a sous chef or so. And that's when 9/11 happened, and the two buildings fell, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was like devastated. It was just really, really hard because I knew a lot of people up there that were there that day. May rest in peace. However, they hired a headhunter, a head chopper is what they hired, a Jewish man
figures.
I won't mention his name, of course, but they hired him to see how they could make the restaurant more profitable. And they cut out my position, so I was unemployed for the first time in 10 and 11 years out of school. So my headhunter, Alfred Ehrlich, the kitchen maestro, I met him at the Javits show, at the motel restaurant show, and he had my resume and told me, this is a funny story, and it's a true one, and I'm going to tell two stories in one. Last week, also a true story, Steven Spielberg's mother came in for dinner. She's a sweet woman. She's been many times, and she has a restaurant, a dairy restaurant in L.A., and, you know, his two sisters were in with their spouses, and they asked how I came to Prime Grill, and I started telling the story, which I'm going to double up on now. So Alfred Earl tells me, this is a real high-end place, Dave. I said, yes, and he goes, it's Midtown Manhattan. I said, and they do lots of meat and steaks. It's good for you. You have that experience. I said, and they do high volume, which you've done also. I said, and he's... I called myself in the middle of this talking to Spielberg, and actually, she goes by a different name now, but, and he actually said this. He said, it's a really high-end spot where people like Steven Spielberg's mother come and dine. And I called myself as I was telling Steven Spielberg's mother this story, and I started laughing, and I said, that was a selling point of me coming here. And I said, I attribute maybe me being here to you and your family for dining at the restaurant. And that's how I came over here to the Prime Grill. And I've been here for about 13 years now.
Now let's talk a little bit about your cookbook.
Sure.
I understand that the cookbook is basically your experience at Prime Grill. And as I went through the cookbook, as I looked through it, I saw a lot of, as I was reading some of the recipes, I saw a lot of interesting variations on old classics. Now, I understand that any chef worth his salt is not just going to do the same thing over and over and over again. I understand that. But some of the variations are unusual. How do you get your ideas? What is it that makes you think, maybe I should add this, maybe I should not add that, and so on and so forth? What is the thought process, the creative process that goes behind it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you're right. It's a primal cookbook by David Glockin, but we have lots of the recipes that we do here in that book, plus other ones that we haven't done or that we've done in the past. But the cool thing is, you know, I kind of look at myself as I've done non-kosher before. So I know what these flavors taste like, and I always try to bring them to the table for my clientele who's never experienced those things. So in that, we started experimenting with duck risotto back, you know, 10 years, 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now we have a full charcuterie board that, you know, you would never have had before. We started making kosher beef bacon, and sorry to use that word bacon, but, you know, I want to tell everyone, all my clients, and I said, it's not the flavor of the swine, let's just say, that people want. It's always a cure and the smoke and the it's the cure and it's the smoke that is what you really want. So, you know, we experiment with all those things, and I try to incorporate them into items like if you read the corn chowder, you know, it's a corn chowder. You know, in Chef's Way, teach you that there's three items in a chowder. It's always cream, which I can't use, unfortunately. It's a pork product, which I can't use. And they're potatoes, which I can use. So if you read the recipe, you know, we use a non-dairy substitute, but we also take the kosher beef-style bacon and we incorporate that into the soup. So, you know, that's something that it's been on the menu and, you know, it brings it to a new level, I feel. And just always trying to twist things up. And, you know, Prime Grill is Prime Grill. There's other restaurants that are a lot more innovative and creative. But I know my clientele, so I always have a couple items that are cool and creative, and then I also have my staples and standards for the person that doesn't want to get too crazy. So so that's that.
How long ago exactly did this book come out? I believe it's only 1 or 2 months, no?
I think it's like 2 or 3 months or so, yeah. It's a funny story. It's in Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon. You can sell it. You can buy it at all of our establishments. But this is really interesting. I a customer, a friend of mine, Kenny Baker, was in last night, and he lives in Chicago, and his company flies him out every Monday, and he flies back Thursday evening or Friday morning before Shabbat, and spends a weekend with his wife and kid. So before leaving, he grabbed the book and asked if I could sign it to his wife. So I did, and apparently one of her friends bought her a cookbook, a kosher cookbook for Hanukkah, and she really wasn't interested in it. So this is in Chicago now. So she brings it back to the store and asks for a refund. The lady says, "Are you sure you really want to refund this? Have you seen the Prime Grill cookbook yet?" So I realize how big this is getting, because now, you know, it's throughout the country, this book. And she says, "Not only have I seen it, but I have a signed copy." So I told that story last night. So I thought that was pretty interesting and flattering. But yeah, it's been out for about 3 months now, and it's doing very well. And good reviews on it so far, so I hope to continue with that.
In 2010, I attended Sal Rizzo's De Gastibus Cooking School, where you were giving a demonstration. After the demonstration, I stayed a little bit to talk to you, and at the time, Sal approached you and I said, "David, when are you writing your book?" And you said, "Not for the foreseeable future." Well, that was in 2010. Now, it's 2013. Obviously, you did not decide to write it in 1 week. It took you a while. What suddenly changed your mind? Why all of a sudden now, yes, you write the book, and why in 2010 you said not for the foreseeable future?
That's a good question. You kind of stumped me why I said not in the foreseeable future. Maybe I just wasn't ready. Maybe I had a lot going on at the time with other restaurants or so. But it came to a point where, you know, the Prime Grill is definitely it's like a New York City institution at this point. You know, we're known throughout the world. And I have stories about that too, which I won't go into unless you let me later. I don't know how much time we have left. But it became time, and my in-house PR marketing director, Marissa Rosenberg, started pitching an idea, and we started researching it, and then Marissa Rosenberg's brother, Zach Rosenberg, actually got us a cookbook deal with Pelican Publishers, and so it happened. So it was about a year and a half project or so, and then editing and food photography and recipe testing and tasting. It was, you know, a big project, but I'm happy I did it. It's I'm proud of the book. I think it's a lovely book. I think it's a tabletop book. It's, you know, it's a
absolutely
hardcover, lots of pictures. There's recipes that are approachable for the home cook. There's some more challenging for the home cook too. But you know, one thing that I do, especially when I do these demos, like we did at Augustus, Sal Rizzo School, is I try to, by the way, I'm doing a class on teaching recipes from this cookbook, actually, in the spring, when we guest chefs this spring. So I don't.
Where will you be doing it? Also at the Gustibus?
At the Gustibus, yeah. There's you call and book your tickets there. I think it's May 4th or so. I'm doing something at the 92nd Street Y also, a big demonstration. That's I'm not really sure all the dates where I'm going to be doing these things, but it's coming in the spring, so you can call if you're interested at the Gustibus at Macy's. But it was just time. It was time in my career. I figured, you know, I was turning 40, and at 40 I think it's a good age to have the first cookbook
yes,
out.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
now that you've published this cookbook, in the back of your mind, at least, are there any plans for any future cookbooks?
Absolutely. Let's see how this one does first. You know, like I said, I'm not going to say not in the foreseeable future. I'm going to say you never know what tomorrow brings. But let's see how this one goes. So far, it's going pretty well. And the next one, I think, would just be my cookbook. It won't be, you know, be cookbook that the Dave Kolotkin cookbook, let's say. Mm-hmm. Cooking Kosher with Kolotkin.
I like that title.
I like that, too.
Now, as I've been leafing through the book, a lot of the recipes are, as you said, stuff that was done here. Quite a few of them I've had here. Quite a few of them I've enjoyed here. And now I know the secrets. I was able to do a few of them. For example, every time that I've come here, one of my choices usually was the porcini mushroom soup. And last, our last review at the Solo, we actually had that porcini mushroom soup again. And it's interesting, even though it's your menu, even though it's your recipe, how each time at each restaurant there is a slight variation, and each time it's an incredibly beautiful surprise. That's what I like about your cookbook. The fact is that, yes, there is a set recipe, but you give the reader, the home cook, you give them the chance to make their own little variation and still come up with a masterpiece. That, to me, is what makes a cookbook great. I remember back in the olden days, you used to have cookbooks like Irma Rombauer's The Joy of Cooking. Very dry book. It was just a recipe, period, and you had to follow it. If you the slightest variation, it didn't work out. Those days are gone. Thank God. There is a whole evolution in the way cooking is done, whether at a restaurant, whether at home. And what I like about your particular book is that you recognize that and you adapt it to the home cook. And as I went through the recipes, it gave me ideas for my own recipes. Long ago, when I was in high school, when I, at the time, I wanted to be a teacher, so I spoke to one of my professors, and he says to me, the great teacher is not one who is going to teach you something, but the great teacher is the one who is going to make sure that you know how to do something different. And that is exactly what I've seen in your book. You don't just show me the recipe, but you give me enough ideas to come up with my own variations, with my own masterpieces. And that is the beauty of any cookbook. Now, why don't you tell us, just so our listeners can hear, who the person behind the name David Kolatkin is. Tell us a couple of interesting or heartwarming anecdotes about your work, about your life.
That's an interesting question. The man behind the mask, huh?
Right, absolutely.
I'm a true, real person. I think if one thing any of my friends or family could say is that I have an impeccable work ethic. I was actually talking to my mother the other day, and I pretty much told her I dedicated my whole 40 years to this restaurant business. And she wasn't too happy about it because, you know, I haven't been home for Thanksgiving. I did the math in 17 years because I'm always here.
Right.
We're at other, you know, restaurants of the past. But who am I? I'm a hardworking individual, married man, no kids. I live in Forest Hills, Queens.
How about some interesting anecdotes?
Give me an example.
Something funny or something that at the time may have seemed annoying, and yet as you look back, you see it in a different perspective.
In the career? In the profession?
Yes, in your profession, in your career.
At the time a rack of lamb came back at Winners on the World because the customer decided they didn't want it, and one of the cooks grabbed it and brought it below the line for me not to see. And his neighboring cook went to take a piece out of it, and he says, you stay away from my rack of lamb. And the guy tried to cut into it, and he took a steak knife and stabbed the guy in the leg. And I'm not going to say it's funny, but these are the things that happen. And next thing you know, this gentleman who, you know, it's funny, because he later became the chef for Sushi Mitsuyan, believe it or not. And he heard my name through the profession, and I'm not going to mention his name, but and contacted me, and said, I hear you're the chef of the Prime Grill. And he says, I'm the chef of Sushi Mitsuyan. But anyway, this gentleman comes from the side of the line, and he had so much blood coming from his leg, I've got to be honest, that it was actually like brown. It was not even like red. And
oh
I
God.
Said, what's going on? And he says, he stabbed me. And I said, what? He says, yes, so-and-so stabbed me in my leg. So I think I wrapped his leg up, and I called in-house security and told him what was going on, and I took this the criminal and the victim and separated them, and then the police came, and I just remember there's a memo going out saying that Kurt and myself, Kurt was my colleague, who's a sous chef that worked with me, that we did a fantastic job on defusing a very bad situation. We did everything right. We called security. Not like it was, to me it was a no-brainer. We called security, and we separated the two, and whatever. One guy was taken away in handcuffs. So is that a funny thing? No, but it's these are the things that happen in this profession. And, you know, you read Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential.
Right, right.
I can't get enough of that book because it's so true. Other stories. I have stories. I can't even tell you all the stories, to be honest. Stories like his. How about Miami? We opened a restaurant in Miami, and I just, you know, like, better yet, here at Prime Grill on 25 West 76th Street, Manhattan. It was opening day, and I was talking to one of the purveyors at a table with my chef de cuisine, Willie Lopez, and all of a sudden, it's opening day. We're opening in 3 hours, and I have all my mise en place, all my preparation out, and all of a sudden I heard something hissing. So I looked into the kitchen because the kitchen is open, and I thought it was steam, so I thought one of the steam kettles busted. So I go in there, and apparently the kitchen got so hot, and they didn't set the links on the Ansel system at a heavy enough strength, and the Ansel system dropped, which is a fire suppression system, which is chemicals, and the whole kitchen was doused in chemicals.
Oh my God.
Okay, and that's it. So what happens, everything goes in the garbage and you have to start from scratch. And that was opening day. We had been closed for about 6 months and everyone's anticipating this day. And there's enough stress on opening any restaurant.
Of course.
But that happens, you know. Another time in Miami, when they're coaching our kitchen, we were all in the patio doing many work and discussing about employee and staff training. And the same thing. They're coaching the kitchen, they put the flames too high against one of the heads and they busted and there's water everywhere, you know? And the time where the rabbis, this is funny, the rabbi actually, I had a smoke box down there and he melted it with a torch. And this is for Passover, he's coaching the kitchen for Passover. And I had smoked salmon advertised all over Miami on my menu, and now I couldn't have nothing to smoke the salmon in because they melted my smoke box. So the things you do when you're a chef, because, you know, there's a lot more to being a chef than being a good cook, you know.
Of course.
It's getting to work in a snowstorm to smoking salmon without a smoker. So I took a rolling rack, which is like a big rack that we put cheese trays on, that has wheels on it, and I took a bunch of perforated cheek pans and laid the salmon on that had been cured already. And I wrapped the whole thing in aluminum foil. Now, this is North Miami Beach. This is not Manhattan. So I was able to roll this outside. And I put a chimney underneath it. And I smoked the salmon outside in the parking lot. So it's another story, just like another day in the life of a chef. You know, just getting food to the table for my customer. And, you know, a lot of times when we open at 5:30 for dinner and we turn the music on and we dim the lights down, it's kind of like opening the curtains at a Broadway show. You know, you don't know what went on, the rehearsing and what it took to get there. Once those curtains open, God willing, you know, the customer doesn't feel the craziness of what it was like to get that curtain open.
One of the things that we always liked about Chef David is that in spite of the fact that he is one of the most prestigious kosher chefs in America, he doesn't have any airs. He doesn't consider himself. He doesn't act like a prima donna. He's just one of the people, always charming, always full of passion about food, always very helpful to the clients. He is, in other words, in plain English, plain Yiddish, whatever language you want, a mensch, a real mensch. Chef David, it was a pleasure talking to you this evening. Thank you very, very much for agreeing to talk to us.
It was more than a pleasure and actual enjoyment. And I don't think your listeners know, but I'm glad you enjoyed your chocolate babka bread pudding and your double espresso while we were doing this interview.
Thank you very much. Good night, one and all. And tune us in again next week. Good night. One and all, and thank you for listening.